Welcome to a special Bengals Beat Podcast four-part series presented by Cincinnati.com and Inquirer Sports. The Bengals don't currently have a Ring of Honor or a Hall of Fame, but that's not stopping us, the Inquirer, from discussing who would constitute an inaugural four-member class should the organization ever decide to start one. So over the next 4 weeks, one at a time, we'll pick the members of our class and sit down for a podcast conversation with them, rehashing memories, discussing the state of football, and, of course, the current Bengals. Enjoy the series. All right, welcome to a very special edition of the BBP. This is the first of a four-part series where we are going to be breaking down who we would put into a four-person mythical Bengals Ring of Honor. You can sit and debate these types of things all the time, and when we're sitting around during the dead period NFL season, why not now? Let's do it. This is going to be a great opportunity to hear from some Bengals legends, to be honest with you. I love the debate and love the idea of picking who these four people would be, and everyone would go on Cincinnati.com, vote in our poll, pick who your four would be. Love hearing from those that I've heard from already, just from the teaser that we dropped on the last BBP after minicamp. Go on there and vote and pick who your four be. But mainly, we want you to be able to hear from the greatest players in Bengals history. This is about the people that we picked, how they're doing, and them talking about the state of the game and so many other things out there. Bengals history, all that type of stuff. You know, a lot of people that have listen to the podcast are loyal BBPers. Maybe aren't familiar with some of the guys that are in this debate and don't know a lot about them. So kind of a cool way to learn a little bit about Bengals history and talk to some of the best players in the history of the franchise. Of course, the Bengals don't have a Ring of Honor currently or a Hall of Fame or anything. One of the few teams in the NFL that don't. And we talked with the team last year about it, right before the season started. I talked with Mike Brown. And he had this to say about it then. He said, I understand the players. They want to be remembered, and I think it's a good thing to do that. We have never traded here on nostalgia. That's probably my fault, because a little of it is a good thing. Fans like that sort of thing. What I'm saying is I'm stewing on it. I'm aware of the discomfort with our position. That's kind of where they stand. We asked them if they wanted to have any, if they had any updates on the possibility of doing something like that, and just said no. They're pretty much gonna stand with what Mike had to say last year, and that's pretty much it. He says when talking about it, it's me. It's in my bones. Like everyone, I tend to look backwards some, but I'm always focused on what's coming next. We've had decades now of wonderful players here. I can understand why people feel we should have celebrated them more and perpetuated their achievements better than we have. He said, I'm probably at fault. Mike was as open about it last year as he's ever been. But we're certainly not here to try to take that position down. We're just here to celebrate some of the players that we would have in our Ring of Honor if we were the ones choosing. And really, I'm pretty sure everybody admits who the first person would be into any Bengals Ring of Honor. And that was my guest today, who is the only Bengals player in the Football Hall of Fame. He is arguably the best left tackle of all time, Anthony Munoz. I was able to catch up with Anthony last month at one of his Anthony Munoz Foundation events at Sycamore High School, one of his character camps. He does tons of work like that in the community, not just here, but all the way across the NFL. So had a chance to catch up with a lot about that, where his foundation's at, a little bit of telling some old stories about the Bengals from the 80s, and exiting his career, and really advice for current players I thought was really interesting perspective that he was able to offer up. And of course, we talked about some of the current Bengals and where that team's at. So without further ado, I want to jump right into it. The first of our four-part series, we'll unveil one each week now until we get pretty much right up to get close to training camp. So hope you enjoy the series and go on to Cincinnati.com. Tell us who your four would be, fill out the poll, and look forward to hearing from you. But In the meantime, Anthony Munoz. All right, well, obviously with the first installment of our Inquirer Mythical Bengals Ring of Honor conversation, we have to start with Anthony Munoz. I'm going to run down the credentials. You know them. But in case anybody of our, you know, podcasts, we skew much younger with these. So maybe there are some people that aren't as familiar. 11-time Pro Bowl, 9-time first-team All-Pro, of course, 2-time AFC champion, 1991 Walter Payton Man of the Year, and in 1998, of course, induction into the Professional Football Hall of Fame. Cincinnati resident, Cincinnati icon, Anthony Munoz Foundation founder, all of that. It's kind of been a wild ride, but here we are. We're here now at Sycamore High School as you're having one of your events. Your foundation has just turned into this thing now. What's it like to watch what your foundation is turning into these days?
You know, it's exciting. Anytime you can get 300 to 400 kids at Sycamore, and actually this is our 16th year doing this camp, when actually our foundation only 15 years old. Yeah. We started a year before the foundation doing this camp, and the fun thing for me is seeing not only the kids, but the coaches that we assemble, the coaching staff. Coach Andy Oles, who's the head coach at Kings High School, is phenomenal. I mean, he runs all my camps for my foundation, and I'm sure we'll talk about it. We're doing a lot of national camps, and he runs those. But to see these kids that, you know, we use football as a hook, but it's not 100% football. We changed the template several years ago. So now it's like a third football, a third, you know, team building, a third character. And, you know, I tell the coaches, you know, we get a lot of young coaches that, you know, probably heard of me, didn't watch me play. And I tell them, you know, I'm an old guy and I've done a lot of football camps. And if this was just primarily a football camp, as much as I love the game, as much as the game's done for me, probably wouldn't be doing just a primary football camp. So the fact that we can use football as a hook and do, you know, the other components is great. The foundation, you know, this is our big week of events. We just had a big dinner Sunday night where we had over 400 people at the Manor House, Bill and Kathy Kinane, tremendous partners. Then Monday out at TPC, our 15th golf tournament. The club is 15 years old. We've had our tournament there 15 years. We had a, you know, great field of not only corporate teams, 32, we maxed it out, but local guys like Jim Breach and, you know, Marvin Lewis was out there, Ken Sampezi, Darren Simmons, Kevin Cole, coaches, but then Witt and Bowling and Huber, and then a lot of the former players, you know, Lapham and Fulcher and Bussey. And so, and then you dip into other sports, you know, guys like Byron Larkin. And so, you know, it's one of those things where we go out and have a great time on the golf course. One of the neat things we've done the last several years is hole number 7, a little par 3 hole, signature hole. We put bleachers, chairs out there, and I think this year we invited a little over 100 vets. So we get them out there, Skyline's there with food, DJ Toad's there, we have music, we have a mic, and kind of took that from the waste management, you know, yeah, tournament where they had that little stadium. Eventually, hopefully, we can get more and more people there. But they're allowed to cheer or, you know, rip on the guys. And we have giveaways. We feed the vets and stuff. So that's a neat thing. And then, of course, you know, we finish the week with our 3-day camp. You know, this is the third day. And, you know, and that's only part of what we do at the foundation. We have about 5-6 other programs. So I'm excited not only for our staff, interns, volunteers, board members, but as you know, this community is so engaged and so giving. We have so many great corporate partners.
You probably now, when you start getting to 15 years in, you start seeing kids that were in your camp. Maybe they're working for your foundation or their coaches, or they start moving on. I mean, you can now you start to see the blossoming of the program because they start becoming adults now.
Well, you're right. We have two overnight camps. We call them our care. One's an Impact for Eternity camp. Another one is a Hispanic Character camp. Both similar templates, but they're overnight. This year, this past April, for the first time, we had a young man who had been there as a camper. His father worked it as a coach. He'd been there as a kid. He was actually, as a senior in high school, he was one of the head coaches for the camp. Another example, we just gave away eight $20,000 scholarships Sunday night. One of our recipients, Victor Ponce, gets $20,000. He's going to MKU. 5 years ago, he was a participant in our Hispanic overnight camp. And I totally remember because we had a marketing video we put together, and we just happened to pull him out 5 years ago to ask him questions. And I sat and talked to him as an eighth grader. He he was interested. He goes, Mr. Munoz, I want to go to college.
Yeah.
I want to go to college. I want to do this. Now, 5 years later, we interviewed him. He was a 4.9 at Colerain High School, and he's one of our scholarship recipients. So it's cool to see that. And now the campers are becoming volunteers, scholarship recipients, and then hopefully, if we don't hire him, some of our corporate partners can hire him as they get out of college.
Yeah,
awesome stuff that you guys are doing. Well, we're obviously doing this sort of Ring of Honor, lots of honoring talk and things like that. You obviously 1998 Hall of Fame, proud Hall of Famer, wearing the Hall of Fame hat. You always got some Hall of Fame stuff on. Tell me this. I mean, when you start getting into this type of stuff, what did your induction in the Hall of 98, what did that mean to you?
Well, as I look back to when I got word and then I started putting my speech together, you start thinking about those that were placed in your life along the way, the journey, from my mom to coaches to family to teachers to teammates, and so living here in Cincinnati, being around former teammates, it's a constant reminder of why I get to wear this Hall of Fame apparel and why I'm up in Canton is because of the teammates I had and those that poured into my life. I mean, the great thing for me over the 16 years that we've done this camp, we've had a number of former teammates that are working. This year, Michael Martin's here. He comes in, he used to be at TAP, but he's no longer there. He comes in from Chicago. He's in with the recruiting company. Bruce Kozerski, head coach at Holy Cross. I think he has like five or six of his coaches. They've been doing this camp. And then Jimmy Turner, we played together. So it's great to have former teammates. But when I think about the Hall of Fame, it's one of those things where I still pinch myself. Every August when we're driving up 71 to go to camp, Canton, it's like, man, Didi, can you believe we're going to the Hall of Fame? And not just to visit and to tour, but, I'm actually in there. I've been in there for 18 years, and it's still very humbling. And you think about the Hall of Fame, and you think about guys like Gale Sayers and Marilyn Olsen and Deacon Jones and Bart Starr, and now it's like, well, I'm one of their teammates. And so it is humbling, but it's so exciting to be able to, be referred to as a Pro Football Hall of Famer.
You go back, and that weekend is so crazy for inductees every year. There's a speech. You see your bus for the first time. You take the tour. Going back from that weekend, what was the most memorable part of it for you?
Was Monday getting to rest? No, it was. They've kind of, at least. From when we first got there, it was like you just had enough time to go back and change shirts. I mean, it was like they had the driver and Didi and the kids. It was just like, we're here, we're there. The funny thing about it, that was, I think, might have been the last year they had the ceremony on the stairs. I did not get a chance to go through the Hall of Fame. So, like 2 weeks later, Michael was going into his junior year at Moeller. They were playing Warren Harding up north, and Didi and I and Michelle spent the night in Canton Friday night. All day Saturday, we toured the building so we could see it, and then we drove up to Michael's game. So it was a blur, but it was so exciting. I mean, the people up in Canton, to this day, I mean, you just love going up there and seeing the tremendous job they do, and they're all volunteers, and just how it's just clockwork. Every event, to see the parade, how big that's gotten, the gold jacket ceremony, and now, of course, with our new president, we got a big, Legends concert now. So, started out last year with Aerosmith. This year we got Tim McGraw. So, it's pretty cool to see that what's evolving, the progress of the Hall.
What are those Hall of Fame meetings like when it's just Hall of Famers inside it? You can tell us the secrets. Like, we want to know.
Let's put it this, there's no filters.
Yeah.
You get guys that get up. You got your president of the Hall of Fame. You got your commissioner. And you got a couple other people. And it's time to just air out. I mean, a lot of good stuff, but a lot of concerns. I mean, of the state of the game, what's going on. So, it's fun for me to see guys that still have been out for a long time, but still know the game, still follow the game, are still in tune with what's going on in the game, and they share their opinions. And hopefully when there's opinions shared that are, concerns of the state of the game, that, the commissioner and his people will hear, and I think they do, and they listen, and our staff is phenomenal there in Canton. So it's pretty exciting to see guys stand up and really share their hearts and their passion still for the game.
What are your concerns about the state of the game in those meetings? What fuels you when you're talking there?
Well, I mean, like anything, you're concerned about the incidents that happen, but then you got to take a step back and you say, okay, we're a microcosm of society. Until all those things are wiped out of society, you're going to continue to have it regardless of what arena you're in. But my concern is that we aren't reactive, but we're proactive in what we do with programs and being ready when those things happen. Not, okay, well, this happened, so now we're going to implement this program. No, let's do things and know what's going on. Let's be aware of what's going on in society. And that, like I said, we're part of that. So let's put these programs together and get them rolling. And then when that happens, then we can just kind of go right into it and attack them. And that's really the one problem, because I love this game. I love what's going on with the game. And I really want to keep the integrity of the game as far as, you know, on the field and off the field. And I think that's the only thing that I'd like to see are programs to really attack what's happened and not attack it after it happens.
Yeah. Tripping back briefly to your career, which of the two Super Bowls still keeps you up?
Both, because there's both were against the number 16.
Yeah.
So it's like, it doesn't matter if it's a frigid Pontiac or sunny Miami, I still see number 16, you know, hoisting that Lombardi trophy. You know, the crazy thing is that, you know, both of them were so close, and both of them were, you know, could have gone either way. So it's not like one we didn't have a chance or the other we didn't have a chance. I think both games were very capable of winning the games. So, you know, they're still, even though the first one was early in my career and it's further away, and I still replay a lot of both games. You know, it's kind of like I still have the ability to replay a lot of my career game. But those games especially, you know, I think about those four shots on the one-yard line with, you know, I tell people if I was a betting man, I would have bet my house that we would have scored at least one of those times. And then, of course, you know, in Miami, that last drive, I mean, especially when they had third and forever, and, you know, Rice breaks the tackle. You know, people think, you know, Montana to, you know, to
Taylor
is the big thing. Yeah,
I hate to bring it up.
Forgot
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
But
sorry.
You think about Rice, and he had what, over 200 yards, and one of the big ones was that tackle he broke on the third and forever. So you know, I still see Crumry laying on the, you know, turf. I still, you know, just certain things that I still kind of replay. So pick one or the other, and they both are right there.
You know, what's one team, obviously 81, 88 teams make the run and they go all the way to the Super Bowl. What's one team from your career that you thought was going to be one to make a Super Bowl run that didn't pan out that way? Is there one that sticks out to you that was sort of, oh, that could have been the one?
Well, you know, I think we had, you know, we did in 88. I thought prior to that, I mean, 86, I thought we were just as good. You know, of course, 87 was the strike year, and we might as well forget about that season. The great thing is we turned it completely around in 88. But, you know, right in that period between 85 and 89, I thought we had a chance to make a run every year because of the talent. I mean, you know, we had, you know, Boomer, of course. You know, we had the same line, you know, for a number of years. You know, defense was pretty much intact with our secondary. You know, Collinsworth was still healthy in those years. So, you know, I can take any one of those teams. I felt, you know, I believe one of those years we went 10-6 and didn't even make the playoffs.
Right.
And, you know, so I thought we, you know, to have the top running game for all those years. I mean, we had a number one running game a lot in the 80s. And, you know, and we averaged a lot of points, you know. So it was a little frustrating that we couldn't get it rolling as much as we did.
Bruce Smith said in the 88 championship game, if he doesn't get hurt, he would have had his best game and you would have had your worst game. Is that crazy talk to you? Have you ever talked to Bruce about those battles? He was probably had to have been one of the toughest guys ever to block.
He was definitely the best guy I ever played. You know, I would have said one out of six games wouldn't have been bad if he would have had a great game.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's interesting how he, you know, I'm sure he was hurt, but we also ran the ball for, you know, over 200 yards, and I don't think we would have passed it much, even if he hadn't got hurt. You know, he got the one sack early and hit Boomer late, you know, a couple plays early in the game. But, you know, we know how to handle those things, and I wouldn't go let him. So, you know, I'm sure he has confidence that he would have probably had the best game of his career against me. But like I said, honestly, one out of six isn't bad against one of the best players you ever play.
Yeah. I mean, is there, absolutely. Is there, do you have a list in your head of – who those guys were, the toughest guys ever to block?
I mean, I can just go right down the line. I mean, my rookie year, Leroy Selman, I played him twice in the first month of my career. You know, Sean Jones, Clyde Simmons, you know, Bruce Smith, you know, Elvin Buffet, I caught him late in his career. Cedric Cartman, I mean, they were late in their career, but still, they were beasts. You know, Greg Townsend. You know, the whole focus was on Howie Long, but Greg Townsend for the Raiders was unbelievable. You know, Big Daddy Carl Harrison, you know, when he left Philly and came to Cleveland. You know, then all of a sudden, you know, my career, it was pretty cool because I went from seeing guys every down as defensive ends, all of a sudden third down, they'd disappear, and they'd start putting Clay Matthews down, Rufus Porter, Derek Smith, or Derek Thomas, you know, Pat Swilling. Then I had to block, you know, guys that they were – that's when they started putting those pass rushers down. And, you know, so I had to prepare for the big DEs, and then all of a sudden the 230 to 240, you know, linebackers that were rush guys. And so that was – you know, there's a lot of – I mean, I can just go on and on to name all those guys that, you know, I played against that were – you know, at left tackle, you're usually playing the best pass rusher.
How different would it be for you today to play in today's game? There's – the game obviously is so different from an offensive standpoint. It seems to me you were seeing in these last few years a shift for a number of teams where the outside pass rusher is not as important as the interior guy, and you're seeing a rise in the importance of these interior linemen because of all the quick passing game that's taken over. Do you see that passing over, and how different is offensive line play today from what it was, you know, when you were playing?
Well, you know, when I started, we were started to allow the extension of the arms, use the hands. I think I would enjoy it a little more today because it's more of a sumo grab and hold, you know, as long as you let them go before the ball's there. And I mean, I say it facetiously, but I mean, really, you look at it, and you still have the, you know, you're right, the interior guys, I mean, you get those big defensive tackles that aren't only big, but they can get right there in a hurry, but you still have those edge pass rush, and I think, you know, Denver showed that they're still very important. Just ask Cam Newton, you know, about that. You know, you still got to have those outside pass rushers. So it has changed, but, you know, I tell people the game has changed, bigger, stronger, faster, but you look at the teams that win, and you can throw for, you know, 6,000, 7,000 yards, but what do you still have to do? Offensive linemen still have to be able to put their hand down and bust people and run the football. And you can go team by team, and they still run the football, and they still get it done. So it is a different game, but I think still, you know, there's still a lot of similarities. Still have to be able to do a lot of the same things. Plus, I would love being 340 instead of, you know, 300 now. You know?
Right.
eat as much as I want and, you know, and still do that. Know that the ball is going to be gone in a hurry. Because, you know, we had 5 steps, 7 steps back then. You know, right now it's like 1, 2, gone. 1, 2, 3, gone. You know,
it's
like, love it.
I mentioned Man of the Year in 91, and you obviously started this foundation, which has become such a huge part of your post-career life. When did you start thinking about what you wanted to do after football? Was that from before you got into it? Was it a couple of years to go, or was it right when you retired? And what was that process like for you?
You know, it's interesting because I kind of fell into it. So my last couple of years, Jim McNally would let me take guys and work on the side as we were playing and practicing. And we brought one guy in, and he said, you know, during practice, he goes, go work him out for a little bit and tell me if he's a guard or tackle.
Yeah.
So he had been playing tackle. I brought him back. You know, after about 10 minutes, I said, he's a guard. Jim said, you're right. And, you know, so I got that feel. And then my last 7 years playing, you know, with the Bengals, I did high school football and radio, which I started during the strike year, and I loved it. So I thought, well, maybe I can do a little broadcasting afterwards. So when I retired, I knew I was either going to go into broadcasting or go into coaching. So I was really checking both out. Jim McNally took me to the combine with him. You know, I started kind of, you know, checking that out. John Robinson, who coached me a week after my last game, you know, called me and asked me to be the line coach at SC with them. And then I interviewed with NBC and CBS. And then, you know, I signed actually with Tampa, which a lot of people don't know. I was down there and I didn't play the season. I made it through camp. So after I had the surgery on my shoulder, I stayed there for like 3 months helping Bob Wiley, who was teaching everything that Jim McNally taught me for 13 years. And so CBS called me and said, are you retired for sure? I said, yeah. So I did 2 games for CBS during that time in Tampa. And then, of course, it happens that Fox got the NFL that following year, and Ed Gorin, who hired me, went over to Fox. So I decided I wanted to watch my kids grow up because they were 9-11 when I retired. So I went into broadcasting. Did that for 7 years. Loved it. Worked with other groups. Had thought about a foundation, but really I was busy. I mean, being a father, being a husband, and even when I was playing, being a player, and then I was working. So 7 years I left. After 7 years of broadcasting, because now my kids were going to college, I wanted to watch them play again. You know, broadcasting weekends, Michael's playing weekends, and Michelle. So I left broadcasting. So a year after I left broadcasting, then I started thinking, okay, I've been thinking about this foundation. I've been formulating my mission statement, talking to different people. So it was a year after I left broadcasting that I established, 8 years after I retired, when I started the foundation. And I knew now I could go to a football game at Tennessee, come home, and put my time in. And, you know, so I left broadcasting. Those 5 years when I left, I mean, so many other things came my way. I mean, I've had 3 to 6 companies every year that I promote, you know, kind of the furniture fair, Rose Automotive, those type of things. So that allowed me to spend all my time doing whatever I want to do on the foundation. So I've been totally engaged for 15 years. And it was funny because as soon as Michael and Michelle graduated from college, which was 5 years because they stayed 5 years, they graduated in 3, but they stayed because of injury. My agent, who handled my TV contract, called me and said, "Are you ready to go back into TV?" I said, "Alan, I said, I got so many things going on." I said, so that's when I continued to do the preseason games and just started doing all this other stuff. So I knew that I had the relationships in place, corporate relationships, and then that's when I started the foundation in 02. And, you know, so I was doing the foundation and going down to Knoxville and watching Michael, and then Michelle transferred to Ohio State. So we're driving all over the, you know, all the Big Ten teams. And so, you know, I kind of knew what I wanted. I mean, I wasn't sure. You know, I was kind of trying to decide, but I knew there was two things, either coaching or broadcasting.
It's funny, so many guys today struggle with how to exit the game and restart. Right. And it's a challenge, you know, it's tough on a number of levels. Yeah. What's the biggest thing that guys miss in how to make that transition from leaving football and then starting over with their post-football career?
I really believe a big part of that is separating you as a person and you as a football player. You put your total identification on number 78, Bengal Stripes. That's who I am. That's who I'll always be. And it doesn't work that way. You've got to say, I'm Anthony Munoz a person. I'm Anthony Munoz a football player. It's tough. And I can tell you, I played 13. I mean, 2 Super Bowls, Hawaii, number. It was still tough. I did that for over 20 years. My body was, you know, that first July after I retired, I had a suit and tie on doing a football game. I'm thinking, what the heck am I doing? A suit and tie should be having a, you know. It's tough. I don't care what kind of career, that transition's tough. It's made even tougher when, you know, your total identity is wrapped up in who you are as a player.
Yeah.
So that's why I tell young men that are entering the league, surround yourself that could care with people that could care less if you ever played a down in the NFL. My wife and I, we have 40, 50 couples that we made an effort to surround ourselves with, and they're still friends now 35, 36 years later that we're, you know, out of the game or when we started the game. But I think that's a key thing is, you know, that's your job. That's something that you do. It's not who you totally are. And I think that's a big thing. If you can separate that, it makes it, doesn't make it easy, but it makes it easier.
Two things, and I'll get you out of here. One, how can people help and contribute to your foundation? What's the best way for them to help everything that you're, because you have a number of different programs.
Right.
You've got the Lineman of the Year, you've got the Impact for Eternity, you've got Straight A Scholarship, the AMF Scholarship Fund, your Football Academy, Youth Leadership Seminar, the Hispanic Character Camp, Wiz Kids and your Character Camps. You're doing all over the NFL. You've got 8 teams now. Well, how can people help that?
Well, I mean, you just rattled off, and really, the Lineman of the Year is the only recognition award. I mean, everything else we put together with 3 staff, we put together the program. So you can go on MunozFoundation.org, and we take everything from volunteers to financial, you know, support. So I mean, if you see a program that you say, I can be a mentor to, you know, at Padilla Roberts Academy, you know, with one of these elementary kids, I can donate a day every week for the whole school year, be a tutor. Or I can come out to our youth leadership seminar at Xavier, where we have 100 high schools, and donate your time. Or you want to come out and help set up or be a volunteer. We just had our dinner where we have 500 people, our golf tournament, where we probably utilize 120 volunteers. Or if you want to write a check, I mean, you know, we need money to, because every one of those programs you just rattled up, not one kid pays a penny.
Yeah.
We just gave out 8 $20,000 scholarships. We have, you know, we send out 500 invites. We usually get anywhere from 350 to 4. Every one of the kids, we feed them 3 times or 3 meals. We feed them every day, all 3 days. We give them apparel. You know, so everything we do, they don't pay a penny. So of course the financial need is there, but you can volunteer. You can. So just go on MunozFoundation.org and see what fits you best as far as, you know, donating your time, your resources, or your finances.
All right. So the last thing, we're putting together the first four for the Bengals, our Bengals mythical ring of honor. You obviously are number one. Rattle off what your four would be. There's a lot of names in the conversation. I'll throw some of the names that we've had in the conversation. Obviously, Kenny Anderson, Boomer. You start with a couple MVP quarterbacks. You get into Willie Anderson, Chad Johnson, Corey Dillon, Ken Riley, Isaac Curtis. You know, it just sticking with players here.
Right.
So where would you pull your four from?
Well, I mean, there's no question.
Three more.
I'd go that, and then I'll throw some other names out there. You definitely got MVP quarterbacks, or, you know, Esiason and Anderson, Kenny Riley, Isaac Curtis. And there's something that this is my personal opinion, along with Hall of Fame offensive linemen. They say the best guard they've ever watched play in their career, and the guy is never mentioned, and you mentioned an offensive lineman, and Willie had an excellent career. But to me, in the top 10 before any other lineman, it's got to be Max Montoya. I mean, the guy, talk to Jim McNally, look at his stats for the 11 years he was here. Nobody even compares it to it. So he would be my first lineman in that group. After you get past, you know, the Anderson, the Esiasons, the Rileys, the, you know, Isaac Curtis, you know, so that's my humble opinion. And, so
well, no surprise, a guy that was in the trenches next to you would be one. I mean, you saw it.
He was a teammate, but we had. I don't think they have it now, but we had charts. I wish you could have seen our classroom. We had charts, and we were graded on every play, 10 different ways, and Max was always at the top for. Every year he started, and people don't know he was drafted as a tackle. And he was here. They had eight linemen. He was here, and Jim McNally moved him to right guard because, you know, when McNally got here, Forrest Gregg, and, you know, he had a couple Pro Bowls. He should have had a few more, but to me, he's, and again, it can be my opinion, but you talk to three or four of the Hall of Fame offensive guards, and they're like, you know, Max Montoya, the best I've watched play.
Yeah.
And I think they know a little bit about offensive guard.
No doubt. Hey, Anthony Munoz, professional football Hall of Famer and our first mythical Ring of Honor member. I'm sure you're probably maybe a little bit more proud of the Pro Football Hall of Fame. We appreciate you joining us here. Thanks a lot, Anthony.
Oh, thank you very much.
Try to be best, because you're only a man, and a man's got the